Hey guys, and welcome to the Dollar Bend. This is Adam. Next to me over here is Sean. Before we get into the interview, we are going to talk a little bit about Free Comic Book Day, which is this weekend, as well as a few other events that Sean has written down that we'd like to kind of go over before we get on to things.
Okay, so it is a busy week this week. Right now, currently, we are missing a charity screening of Firefly episodes.
Yeah.
Put it that way. Borderlands is hosting that at Fitzpatrick's.
Borderlands Comics and Games here in Greenville, South Carolina.
Yes, hosting that here in Greenville, South Carolina.
Yeah.
We are missing that. And you are, too, by the time you hear this.
You've missed it.
But there are things this week that if you listen to this on Wednesday and early Thursday, then you will not miss out on. And those things are as follows.
Mm-hmm.
Thursday at midnight, which I guess that would technically make it Friday, Richard is hosting a midnight screening of the Avengers movie. Did you know there's an Avengers movie coming out?
There's an Avengers movie?
There is. Mm. And this will be at Cherrydale Theater.
Cherrydale. I don't even know where.
It's like Greenville, South Carolina.
Somewhere outside of Greenville, South Carolina.
It's down in here.
Yeah,
somewhere.
But I'm sure a theater near you is showing the Avengers movie at midnight as well.
True, but you will not be there with Adam, myself, and Richard.
And
possibly a few other people.
Probably a few other people.
a few. We might actually want to think about getting tickets.
We should
that.
Think about that.
Probably. Borderlands Comics and Games is also hosting a Marvel versus Capcom tournament sponsored by Buffalo Wild Wings.
On Thursday.
It starts at 6 p.m. and it goes until near midnight. And then they're going to go to screening at, I think they said, the Hollywood 20.
Yeah.
I could be wrong on that, but I think that's what they said. Yeah, there's going to be a rolling video game truck and prizes and all sorts of things.
That's cool.
So you can check those two things out on Thursday.
Yeah, Rob at Borderlands is pretty much doing a Week of the Geek thing.
Yeah, so just, I mean, he's got a lot of stuff going on. We'll see how he is next week. Next week's going to be the week of naps. That's good, right?
Yeah,
okay.
Good.
All right, so, and then Friday, Borderlands is putting together a thing called Art Slam.
Art Slam,
because it's got an exclamation point. Or Art Slam Live.
Art Slam Live.
It's a comic artist challenge. So basically, you get some comic artists, and they are competing for cash on a stage in front of a live audience.
Okay.
That's going to be at the Channel, which is in downtown Greenville.
Off Main Street.
Mm-hmm. It's from 8 p.m. until 11, and it costs $5 to get in. There's going to be food, a DJ, raffles, trivia, or maybe just trivia. No raffles. Just trivia. Sorry, there's a lot of stuff going on. I can't keep track. So there's going to be an artist alley, a DJ, trivia, and it's just $5 to get in. Oh, and special guest, Sanford Green.
Sanford Green's going to be in town.
Yes.
When did that get announced?
I don't know.
It doesn't matter when. Yeah. We're announcing it now.
Yes, before it's actually happened, so you know about it before it's happened. Again, yeah. Friday, 8 p.m. at the Channel, downtown Greenville, Art Slam Live.
Art Slam Live.
Then, as if that weren't enough, Free Comic Day.
Saturday. Free Comic Day at a local comic shop near you. As well as all of the local comic shops near us, which we will be hitting, starting with
Borderlands. I'm gonna see if I can give each of the places justice to what they're gonna be doing.
Okay,
we'll see. So every place has got something crazy going on. Borderlands, we're gonna get there first. Because Blood Connection will be there starting at
eight,
I believe. Eight until noonish.
Okay.
If you give blood before 11 a.m., you will be allowed to get in early and get one of each of all the Free Comic Day books.
At Borderlands.
Mm-hmm. So get there before 11, so you can give blood before 11. So you can go ahead and get your Free Comic Day books and enjoy the rest of your day.
Which I'm going to try to give blood. I don't know. I got a tattoo recently. We'll see what their laws are or their regulations are on that.
Yeah, but I've given blood. I can get one of each for both of us because we can share.
Yeah, if you give blood and you get in and grab one of every book, we're covered.
Exactly.
Solid.
Yes. Blood Connection will also be providing hot dogs, chips, and drinks. Borderlands also has a new website. Very nice. Very nice. Good. I like it. All right. So Borderlands has got a whole bunch of guests coming. We've got Corey Godby. He'll be there from 2:30 to 4. Mm-hmm. Al Bigley, Devin Smith, Mitch Rogers, Travis Tutorow, AJ Simpson, Brandon Hendricks, Joshua Hendricks, Joshua Burrows. They're going to be having artists from Brotherhood of Comic Artists, and people from Sketch Charlotte are going to be there too, and a lot more. They didn't give a specific time for the artists and the sketching, but they open at 11, they close at 7:30, and I imagine the artists will be there sometime in there sketching.
And where are we headed after Borderlands?
After Borderlands, we will be going to Richards Comics and Collectibles.
About 4 blocks down the street?
Not even. Richard's got a whole bunch of stuff going on, too. Yes, in Greenville. All right, so he's got art contests for the kids. He's got raffles, costume characters, FUR, Feline Urgent Rescue will be there, taking donations, giving out prizes. And he's got quite a long list of guests, too. Tracy Yardley, Bobby Nash, J. Chris Campbell, Derek and Nikki Davis, Brad Parton, John Davis, and Corey Gobby will be there. It's listed from 1 to 2. He might be getting there earlier, though. I think his times maybe were amended.
Okay. So, yeah, so he's going to be at Richards, and then he's going to be at Borderlands.
Yes.
And Richards got a lot of new faces, a lot of old faces. And after Richards Comics and Collectibles, we're going to go on a trip.
Yes, we're going to go on a 3-hour tour. No.
Round trip, 3-hour drive.
Yeah, that's true. An hour and a half, pushing 2 hours. We are headed up to Heroes Aren't Hard to Find in Charlotte, yeah. North Carolina. They are going to have their usual craziness. Mm-hmm. Just a whole bunch of people giving out comics. They usually have some kind of dollar books outside. All kinds of crazy stuff. So, who's going to be at Heroes? Let's take a look. Chris Brunner. Uh-huh. Sanford Green. Gonna be seeing him 2 times in a week.
Wow.
That's crazy.
I like that.
I do too.
I like that.
It's a good week. Cully Hamner, Jason Latour, Jackie Lewis. Her new book, Playball, just came out. Oni Press.
Pick it up. We got it.
Yeah, we did.
We gotta read it.
Yep, we do.
It looks good.
Yeah, it does. Jay Potts, Bud Root, Bridget Scheide, Brian Stelfreeze, Sketch Charlotte will be there, specifically Herc Petmazis and Brandon Paget. And rumor has it John Hairston Jr. will be there, although he's not on any list. I'm like 90% sure that I saw that somewhere on something, but I couldn't find it again.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure John Hairston Jr. will be there doing something awesome, which is what he does wherever he is. But I'm pretty sure he'll be at Heroes doing something awesome.
I think this is the year I'm going to get in Stelfreeze's line.
You're a brave man.
Hopefully we'll get there in time. And then, I know that's the end of the week, but I know that I want to mention that Rob of Borderlands on Sunday are doing a charity screening of Avengers. Rob did this for Captain America. He basically bought out a theater room, and he sells the tickets for charity, and all profits and everything goes to...
The proceeds are benefiting the Wounded Warrior Project.
Right. It was fun last time. We went to Captain America for that, and that was good.
Yeah.
It was a fun time.
It was. And if we like Avengers, who knows, maybe we'll go see it again.
Hopefully he'll be sold out of tickets, but if not, yeah, there's a good chance we will.
Also, on the email that Richard sent out,
yes,
he's going to have Rob Vendetti signing at his store May 19th.
Exo Man of War.
Yes. You may know Rob from The Surrogates.
Yeah.
And
Homeland Directive.
Yes. But he's got a new book coming out. Valiant Comics are relaunching their line, and he's writing Exo Man of War. Some people, I hear, are pretty excited about it.
I'm excited about it. It comes out this Wednesday. It comes out today. If you're listening to the day this post, it's out. It's on shelves.
One last thing I want to mention.
Yes.
Don't forget to support your local comic book store while you're there picking up your free comics. There are a lot of awesome books coming out this week. Mm-hmm. You can pick up Animal Man Trade Paperback Volume 1, Daredevil number 12, Sonic the Hedgehog number 236, all kinds of awesome comics for all kinds of fans. I mean, Avengers vs. X-Men number 3, just all sorts of stuff are coming out. So if you stop by the comic book store, pick up something free, at least think about, you know, buying something while you're there.
And remember, Free Comic Book Day is something that the industry does for us, the fans. They don't have to do it. Shops don't have to participate. Artists don't have to participate. And publishers don't have to participate in Free Comic Book Day. They do it for the fans. And the thing that I want to say is, remember, free comics aren't free for the dealers. They have to buy them. So don't be a tool when it comes to free comics. And artists are doing, for the most part, free sketches. So don't be a tool with the artist doing sketches for you. Etiquette, people. That's all I'm saying. I'm going to throw that out there.
Yeah, I mean, if you just happen to miss out on a comic, it was free.
Right.
Somebody else got it. Somebody else that maybe wanted it more, or it might encourage them to come back and read comics.
And Free Comic Book Day is a good opportunity to try something new.
Heroes did a whole blog post. Annie Mansell wrote, basically, try something new.
That's where I got that from.
Yeah.
Totally skeeved that from Andy. Anyway, we've taken enough of your time. You guys want to listen to the interview. So those are the things to look forward to and things that you may have missed. Thanks for listening. On to the interview.
Well, Adam, I mean, I think I sent you the stuff, what, a year and a half ago, I think?
Yeah, and I read all of it, but I didn't get a chance yet to read the Death Jr. stuff. I did read all of the Courtney Crummer and stuff. Right. By I didn't get a chance, I mean, I didn't get around to it. It was sitting in a box covered, like, you mailed it in that box, and it was sitting in the corner of my office, buried under stuff. I'd completely even forgotten about it. To the point of when I opened the box, it had a return slip that you had already put in it for me to mail it back to you, and you no longer live at that house or work at Sportigo, because I think
it wouldn't have been good anyway after a year and a half.
but I finally got, you know, as soon as I did start reading the Courtney Crummer and stuff, I read the first two volumes back to back, like one day and then the next, and then the third volume, it was a pretty big break because and I got my comics for that week, and I read a few other things. And then I got to the third volume. I read the third volume two nights ago, and then I read both of the Courtney Crummer and Tales yesterday when I got home.
Yeah, both of those and something. There's a little bit more is in the fourth trade, which I didn't
fourth
pick
trade.
Up yet. Yeah, there's a fourth trade.
See, I didn't do any research yet, except for the books that I read. So I know nothing about this except for you sent me these books and I enjoyed them.
Well, the only reason I know there's a fourth trade is that the only reason I know there's a fourth trade is I took my son over to the library the other week and I was in the kitchen. I was like, the fuck? There's a fourth trade? When did this come out?
Yeah, I mean, I did notice is when I was flipping through previews, because Sean has me doing that now so I can prepare. Nice. I was flipping through it and I saw that he does have that upcoming Courtney Crummer in comic issues. And it's the first Courtney Crummer in color, so that's pretty exciting, too.
Now, is he doing it as an ongoing now? Is that right?
I don't know. That's what it looked like. Again, all I saw was it in previews, so I'm not sure.
Well, fortunately, we're going to talk to him.
Yeah. All right, Joel, are you there?
Oh, I'm here.
Ted, are you there?
Yeah.
Well, let me start by saying this. I wanted to originally do this about, oh, God, a year and a half ago, Ted. I think I sent you an email originally.
Remember.
Is that right?
That sounds right to me.
A long time ago. We have this thing on the Dollar Bin where we use multiple people when we talk, so we kind of have an unofficial rule that at least two of us have to be familiar with somebody's work before we interview them, or it's just me talking. And
nothing. That makes a difference.
So I sent him a care package about a year and a half ago, and he just sat on it until I threatened him with bodily harm. And but he had a lot of good stuff to say about it, Adam.
No, yeah, that's true. Like as soon as I read the first Courtney Crummer, the next day I immediately read the second one. So I was able.
Oh, that's nice.
I was, however, able to knock out. I knocked out all the Courtney Crummer that Joel sent me, which apparently there's a volume four that he didn't have. but then again, he mailed it to me over a year ago.
Yeah. It wasn't out at the time.
Yeah. But I have not got to. He also sent me the Death Jr., and I haven't got to that yet.
Oh, no hurry.
But I still have it, and we'll get into detail about that. The first thing I want to ask you, Ted, is, and you said it earlier, but how do you pronounce your last name?
Nafee.
Okay.
It's one of those names that kind of is, like, I think the pronunciation evolved over the generations as, like, over years of being in, like, my family living in Texas and Oklahoma, and, like, all these southern places, like Lebanese names, don't quite go over super well. And, you know, southerners are famous for mispronouncing foreign words anyway. So, you know, we're all from Texas and you know, and it just kind of turned from probably what was originally NYFA to NAPE. There you go. But so it looks like it's pronounced differently from what it is because of that. And it's plagued me my entire career. And I seriously thought about, like, you know, coming up with a fake name to, you know, like a, what do you call it, a pen name. Mm-hmm. I'm just not that kind of person.
My, you know, and I think Joel, I guess we were all pronouncing it NYFA, weren't we?
Yeah.
So NAPE.
Yeah, see, it would be easier if it was just pronounced NYFA or NYFA.
Well, and my brother, I have one of those last names that also has changed the way you say it. But my brother, he races cars, and he actually, when he spells it phonetically now, it's just easier.
Oh, yeah.
He's changed the spelling to phonetic spelling.
But
I get it.
But see, the good news is you live in America, so you can spell it S M I T H and still pronounce it NYFA if you want.
Yeah.
But you said you're from Texas, though. But I know that you're in San Francisco. How did you land all the way on the West Coast like that?
My parents tell me that I was born in Texas while they were on their way to San Francisco to California because I didn't. I think I didn't stay in Texas for more than 6 months. So I'm very much a California dude.
Did you grow up around comics? Was this something that that you enjoyed reading?
I discovered comics like right at the time when kids are supposed to be growing out of them, right? Well, you know, it was I was 14 and I was supposed to grow out of comics at that point, you know, because comics were for kids. And then, of course, it was 1986, and guess what came out that year? The Dark Knight Returns. Mm-hmm. And I swear I had abandoned, like, you know, Batman. My Batman was the, you know, the Batman of Adam West, and I had abandoned all that stuff. And then I pick up this comic book, and, you know, I mean, I don't know what you guys' experiences of it was, but at the time it was electrifying. Mm-hmm. Like, really? This is Batman? That's so amazing. Yeah. So that changed my whole attitude about, I mean, and I think at the time too, I was discovering a whole lot of things that I wasn't supposed to enjoy. That were, you know, arguably for kids, like cartoons and stuff like that. And at the time, you know, people listen to this and they think it sounds weird because they don't realize that at the time, cartoons really were only for kids. You know, movies like Heavy Metal were a bizarre anomaly. Mm-hmm. And then we discovered Japanese animation that was for much wider audiences that could get older. And then I'd also discovered, and then America decided to play around with Dark, you know, to produce Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen and play around with this adults doing, you know, like adult, like children's material handled in an adult way. And that was electrifying at the time. And it's still kind of, I mean, we're, you know, as a industry, we're still kind of in love with it. And so that's where I got started with the comics, falling in love with that and just wanting to draw Batman and all that stuff.
Well, see, I grew up in the middle of Arkansas, so I got to miss all of that. There was no Dark Knight Returns, there was no Watchmen, there was no manga, there was no, not until years later. So we missed all of that.
Like, for me, the, you know, Frank Miller was the Batman artist. For everybody else, it was, you know, Jim Aparo. And Jim Aparo was great, but, you know, he's kind of 70s, and Frank Miller's Batman defined the 80s, that kind of 80s comic book aesthetic.
Well, I mean, we've talked about Batman already. Let me jump ahead a little bit on what I wanted to ask, but you've kind of had your own stab at Batman. I mean, who influenced your take on him?
Oh, God. Well, I mean, everybody, you know, everybody. Well, Frank Miller was my first. And then, you know, like, of course, I collected the Bernie Wrightson short story or like Batman Limited series that he did that was really, really cool, beautiful looking. So Wrightson's Batman. I had also collected this Batman book that he did when he made him appear in Swamp Thing, which I was just knocked out by. And then from there, and then, of course, Sienkiewicz had a very brief, got to play around with Batman very briefly in some giant-sized spectacular that, you know, he only did 8 pages, but he just did such a definitive take on Batman that a lot of people ended up stealing from him, including Dave McKean and Todd McFarlane. And they were just so, it was just this neat, like, look at how crazy and wild and kind of exotic you can make this character and still have it be, you know, definitively that character. And I love the Batman because you can really dramatically reinterpret him in all these different ways, and it's still Batman. And so, I mean, all kinds of influences. I mean, Dave McKean's influence, the Arkham Asylum Batman, I love how, you know, and it came out of because he's an artsy-fartsy dude, and he was embarrassed to draw this character, and which I thought was a little silly and kind of not where I was coming from. But I loved how he, because he was a little embarrassed to draw him, he went ahead and just draped him in shadow, just drowned the character in shadow, and it was such a neat effect that it just made me think, like, wow, if I ever got to draw a Batman book, I don't know if I'm ever going to actually draw him not just purely in silhouette. Like, I don't know how much I want to show of this guy. The less you show them, the more funny it is.
Now, I did zero research for this other than reading the Courtney Carmen books. When did you work on Batman? What Batman did you work on?
Well, recently I did something in a giant size annual. That's okay. Like, it was all like newcomers to DC Comics. I had done like maybe one other thing for DC Comics, which was a Riddler story tie-in for the Arkham City graphic novel. Graphic novel, you know, for the game, Arkham City. So I did a short story in the tie-in graphic novel for Arkham City, and then I got to do one panel of Batman. They were nice enough to, like, work in a single panel of Batman, so I would get to do Batman. And I think that the editor just felt sorry for me because I had been telling him I wanted, it was Jim Chadwick, mm-hmm. And I told him that I always dreamed of drawing Batman professionally, and he gave, the only story he had for me was one where Batman isn't in it. It's all Riddler. So he kind of went to the writer and said, hey, could we please just get one panel in there? And so, that was nice for me. And then I got another job doing a short story in a giant size annual that's just all for newcomers. And, you know, I'm working my way up, and I would love to do a lot more, but I'm just so wrapped up in drawing Courtney Cromerin right now that it's hard to take the time to do other things and really commit to like a series or, you know, like I keep saying, I'd love to do like a backup feature, but they're not doing backup features anymore.
Yeah, the medium has changed.
Yeah, it's getting less and less. There are less and less comics in comics. You know, there's a lot of ads.
So I'm going to go ahead and guess that Batman's probably your favorite character then.
Outside of my own characters, absolutely. Yeah, I'm obsessed. I can't seem to shake it. You know, like it started when I was probably 3 years old. I have drawings of Batman from the original TV series that I have from when I was three. I was in love with that. I was in love with the Super Friends. I'm sure there was a couple of Batman and Robin shows that I watched regularly. And I really liked the character. And then just when I was getting too old for that character, The Dark Knight came out, and that my obsession with the character came back with a vengeance and just kind of stayed fixed there ever since. After about, you know, like after, you know, when the Batman movies kind of came out and I didn't like any of them particularly and didn't feel like Michael Keaton really kind of was the Batman that I had always grown up with. Like, I didn't understand. Like, the guy who directed it had just done a movie with Alec Baldwin.
Right.
And he decides to cast the guy who would have been the perfect Joker to play Batman. I didn't get that. I was really excited. Oh, yeah, I hear Michael Keaton got cast. Yeah, he'd make a great Joker.
And
there you go.
And he's Batman. And it's directed yeah. by a guy who doesn't read comic books and is proud of it.
Yeah, which, there you are. Yeah, sorry. I know there's a lot of fans, but I was never one of them. And I had kind of given up on Batman for, you know, and done my own. It's, you know, my comic book career went in this very particular direction of, you know, books for children and tweens, that kind of, you know, like people from about 8 or 9 to like 13. And then Batman Begins came out and I was just electrified again. It all started all over again.
Was that the Batman that you wanted? I mean, do you think they got it right in Batman Begins?
I feel like, you know, I mean, there's a lot of little things that they kind of, that I didn't love, but I think the moment when there's a scene early in the film where Bruce Wayne is about to murder the guy who killed his parents, right? And mm-hmm. then some mob boss kills him, like beats him to it, you know, like has an assassin, the whole thing, you know, story. And all of a sudden, moral simplicity became moral complexity. And that, to me, is what makes Batman interesting, is the moment when you start to pick apart the moral questions that are created by this guy who wants to stop crime by becoming essentially a criminal. And I love that. It reminded you that if Batman is obsessed with vengeance, if the only thing he's interested in is vengeance, he's not really a hero. So it took vengeance away from him. And it said, think about this situation that you're in a much broader sense. Like, is it, you know, is vengeance, okay, now you got it. The guy who murdered your parents is dead. Are you satisfied? Do you have closure? No, it was the opposite. It was completely perverted everything that he thought he wanted out of life at that point. It was just, I thought it was cool.
Well, I got to say this, though. I mean, I looked at your stuff on Batman, and then you look at your run on, from what little bit I've seen, of Polly and the Pirates. Now, unfortunately, neither one of us have read that yet. But you look at your art style on Batman, and then you look at what you did on Death Jr., and then you look at Courtney Cromerin. It seems like you are able to tailor your art style to what it is that you're working on. What kind of art training did you have where you have that ability?
I don't have that much formal training. I went to school for a while. You know, I went to the Academy of Art, which is a local, you know, art college. And I didn't even graduate. I just took classes as I wanted and absorbed as much information as I could, but just studied pop culture, studied comics. But really, I kind of always let the storytelling lead my art style, I felt like, in as much as I could. And I kind of feel still like I'm not really the best at doing, like, cartoony art compared to some, like, people like Junko Mizuno, and, like, the masters of, like, that kind of cartoony style that I employ with Courtney and Polly. And I'm not the best writer in the world by any stretch of the imagination, but somehow there's something nice about combining my art style, letting the art style as well as the, you know, expressiveness tell as much story as the script. And having a unified intention with, you know, as artist and writer, it's a little different from working with other people. It's a little, and like I said, you know, like I'm not the, when you pair me with a, like some other writer, I'm not as good an artist. And when I feel like I'm not as good a writer when I'm paired with other artists. Although, you know, recently the new Polly book actually turned out really well. But I think of it as like I'm trying to write with the pictures, and that's my main focus. And that means, so that, like, if the story needs to be a cartoony style, then that's how I want to draw it, because that's part of the writing. If that's what the writing asks for.
You've answered quite a few of my questions in that alone, and also you've led into about 1,000 of the questions I was going to ask, and now I have to decide where to go from.
Sorry.
No, it's fine.
That's a good problem.
Yeah, like, as you were talking, I was like, I want to ask more about that. the first thing I want to say is that when I did a quick Google search to try to find your Batman, the main stuff that I came across was a lot of sites like CBR and Comics Alliance basically saying to put you on Batman.
Oh yeah, I know, it's pretty nice about it too. And one of these days I'm gonna put aside all my personal projects, and I want to do, like, just devote a year to just drawing Batman. But it has to be the right project, you know. I don't want to just draw it just to draw it. I don't want to draw it with, like, a villain that I'm not into. My dream is to do, like, a standalone Batman project of some kind. But you know, that's really not up to me. It's like that's kind of an arrogant and presumptuous dream. I mean, I kind of feel like I probably would have to pay my dues before I got something like that.
Yeah. I mean, just talking to you and listening to you talk about Batman, I mean, just your knowledge and your passion for the material seems like you would be probably a good person to be on Batman. Now, when I read Courtney Crumrin, and I don't immediately think this guy should be on Batman, but you know, it's
I think that's a big problem, though, is that I chose this particular thing just because you know, you don't know why you make these decisions. It's just that, you know, I didn't decide I want to be a children's comic author. I just had an idea for a children's book that I kind of, you know, like, because I'm a big fan of Roald Dahl.
Oh, he beat me to it. Damn.
I told you.
God damn.
And right. I loved, I love his approach to, like, kind of creepy, scary children's stories. And also, you know, like, I mean, if you've ever read Peter Pan, you know, the Peter Pan stories about how messed up and kind of heartless children are, because they're not, children don't come out automatically good. That's not a human being's default state. We have to work at being good people. You know, we have to see the benefit to our souls of being good people. We have to become aware of our souls and then see the benefit to, like, our self-image in order to become good people, right? Mm-hmm. When little children kind of grow up, you know, just assuming that mom and dad are going to take care of them and not caring what's going on with mom and dad. So, like, in Peter Pan, the kids just abandon their family and go off to Neverland for however long, for a year, like a year. And then at the end of the story, they come back and, like, and that's just the nature. They just come back and just assume that the parents are going to be there waiting. And, of course, the parents are there waiting. And it was kind of, that was the Peter Pan kind of take on the cruelty of innocence, you know?
Yeah.
Like, innocence doesn't mean goodness. Innocence just means you're just too dumb and unself-aware to realize that you're kind of cruel and mean. And that's kind of what the way children are. And I kind of wanted to approach that. That was my main inspiration for Courtney Crumrin. You know, it's actually based on Matilda. I don't know if you know the story Matilda by Roald Dahl, but there was a movie about it.
Danny DeVito.
That Danny DeVito directed. And I just felt like, you know, Danny DeVito just didn't quite understand children's material. He kept trying to make it kind of tacky and grim instead of, you know, delightfully spooky and weird. Yeah. And children, like, respond to spooky and weird. I mean, in a way, I'm not a fan of Tim Burton, but his aesthetic is so perfect for children because he knows how to make things scary and still fun. Mm-hmm. And I felt like Danny DeVito's Matilda was not fun. Yeah. It was grim. It was sad. It was hopeless. And, you know, the only way for Matilda to kind of win, to, you know, to triumph in the story is that is by basically being bestowed with magical powers out of nowhere,
yeah,
and having those magical powers cost nothing. I felt like I wanted to do something that was the opposite of that approach that DeVito took, where I wanted the main character to not be perfect. I mean, she was raised by kind of crappy people, so who weren't taking care of her. So she is messed up, a little cold, a little distant, doesn't have an ability to connect with people, and tends to take unreasonable, insane revenge on, you know, even little kids that are other little kids that are bullying her, because she has that kind of Ender's Game mindset where, you know, if somebody's bullying you, you have to hit back so hard that they'll never bully anyone again.
Right.
Either because they're too scared of being hit again or because they're dead.
Right. Yeah.
And that's kind of Courtney's way of approaching things too. And and of course that comes back to bite her, because there's no way you can't just do that in a vacuum and have no consequences. You do ultimately, you know, a little kid has to learn to be social. But that was my idea for Courtney, like just kind of approaching the, you know, and like you can look at Harry Potter. She's got a lot of Roald Dahl in her, and the Joanne Rowling has a lot of Roald Dahl in the Harry Potter origin story. There's tons of Roald Dahl in that. And I wanted to explore the idea of what happens when a kid is raised by rotten people and doesn't turn out this wonderful, perfect, heroic person. Kind of ends up, and like that's how anti-heroes are formed. They're people who want, you know, like they want to go out, proceed into the world and protect themselves and do good things, but they don't really have a good example of what it is to do good things, so they kind of messed up.
I didn't really get to ask this earlier, but this is one of the other things that came to mind while you were talking. What's the first published work you've done?
Well, back in the early 90s, 91,
mm-hmm,
there was this new comic book company called Image, and they had launched this whole... my first actual job that I worked at and got a paycheck for,
yeah,
was at a comic book store and that summer was the year that Spider-Man came out. And then the next year, I was getting a job drawing comics, and so Image had just started up, and the collector's market was absolutely skyrocketing.
Yeah.
And they just wanted any warm body that knew which way the pencil worked,
yeah,
to draw comics. So I ended up working for Innovation, who made their money by doing the Vampire Lestat comic, which was selling like 60,000, 70,000 copies of an issue, believe it or not. Beautiful work. You know, they were looking to adapt more fantasy novels, horror and fantasy novels. So they got Color of Magic by Terry Pratchett. And I ended up getting Shadow of the Torturer by Gene Wolfe. So my first published work was an adaptation, or the first three issues of a six-issue adaptation of Shadow of the Torturer, which was like a sort of a gothic fantasy set in a very far distant future, like a million years in the future or something.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was like it was a trial by fire. I had no idea what I was doing. I was doing tons of cross-hatching with a rapidograph, and it was very ugly, but... somehow I managed to get nominated for Best Newcomer anyway. I don't know how that happened. Russ Manning would have turned over in his grave. Thank God I got, somebody else got it. Mike Okamoto got it. He was much better than I was. Although he didn't end up with the comics career, and I did, so there you are. Yeah, and so that was my first published work. I was doing the heady pace of about a page a week.
Okay.
Ooh, blister. Yeah. Blister.
Was all that cross-hatching, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just the fact that I just didn't have anything remotely resembling a work ethic.
So what led to the start of Courtney Crumrun?
That was about 10 years later. I had just triumphed with this series called Gloom Cookie that I did with SLG. Gloom Cookie was interesting. I was, you know, I'd kind of been out of comics for about a year working in the video game industry because comics were kind of dead at the time and I didn't get anywhere. Hadn't gone anywhere. And then a friend of mine had this great little short story, and I said, well, let's make this a comic. And so I adapted this two-page short story that she had written, Serena Valentino, into a comic book form, and then we made it into a mini comic, and we took it to San Diego, shopped it around, and SLG just snapped it up. They loved it. And that turned into Gloom Cookie, and that was hugely successful. But then I kind of found that I really wanted to write my own stuff. I had kind of, at first, I was sort of, like, for the first issue of Gloom Cookie, I started co-writing it with Serena, and then we kind of ended up having like an argument over the, like one of the stories in it, and you know, because it was Serena's story, you know, she got, you know, it was ultimately her choice and her decision. And I found myself a little dissatisfied from that point on, not because she wasn't doing a fantastic job, but because I wanted to write my own stuff. Mm-hmm. So I ended up kind of leaving Gloom Cookie, which everybody was telling me was a bad move. We were both friends with Derek Robertson, mm-hmm. and Derek was like, dude, this book is really big and it's a huge success and you're crazy to leave it. and so I did, and I to do something a lot more obscure, Courtney, which was, I mean, the Gloom Cookie had going for it, it was sexy, it was goth, and it was cute. And I couldn't come up with another concept that was all three of those things. So I ended up with something that was cute and goth, but not sexy. Courtney Grumman is not sexy at all.
Thankfully.
yeah. I mean, that's kind of the point. She's this kind of little... Yeah. And, you know, androgynous worm baby that's not actually old enough to be. And so, you know, I went ahead and kind of pitched that around. I pitched it to Slave Labor, but, you know, Dan Votto, you guys, I'm sure, are familiar with Dan Votto. You know, he looked at it and he said, Ted, I don't like this idea. I don't think this character, she's so grumpy. Why would anybody like such a grumpy character? Which, coming from Dan Votto, was pretty rich.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were planning to, and I had not heard from them in like 3 months. I had just come off of this other book, and then I pitched a new thing, and they just didn't look at it for like 3 months. And so I gave up and went and pitched it to some other people in desperation. And, you know, and Oni Press loved it and said, you know, we love how grumpy she is. This is like the, you know, we're going to snap this up and like do a miniseries. And so that became the first miniseries, and it was really successful. I mean, for an independent book. It was never as successful as Gloom Cookie was, but it was successful enough to keep going, and it endured. Like, the first issue has continually sold all this time, and now we're releasing a new full-color hardcover edition that, God, you should see. These are absolutely gorgeous. And it just seems to kind of withstand the test of time, and that's how that all started, was they wanted to announce it for San Diego. Dan wanted to talk me out of it during San Diego. And so, like, I kind of went with them because, you know, they told me what I wanted to hear, which apparently is a good skill for a publisher, you know? Like, you shouldn't be honest with your creators because we're too delicate. You know, we're a little sad, little insecure assholes that, pardon my French, that, you know, can't hear, you know, don't know how to listen to, you know, this, we're not sure that this is working, you know?
Yeah. Like, I haven't read it, but I can picture Gloom Cookies. When you started talking about it, like, I can picture it in my head, but I haven't read it. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's a little more crudely drawn than, mm-hmm. you know, Courtney Kremer is, but I'm still really proud of that work.
It's funny because I love Oni Press, but I can definitely, like, everything I read from Slave Labor is very in the same kind of the niche as Courtney Cromren is. I mean, like, I read Pinocchio Vampire Slayer and some of, like, mm-hmm. Faith Aaron Hicks's stuff, and mm-hmm. it kind of fits in.
Well, it was designed to be a slave labor book. Yeah. That's why it was so strange that they weren't interested.
Yeah,
although,
definitely.
I mean, you know, if Dan Votto had his way, slave labor books wouldn't be like they are. They would be all tiki themed.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I kind of want to see that comic book company that's like an all tiki, like tiki detectives and, you know, tiki horror comics and, you know, blah blah blah.
Now, I do love me some Oni Press. Oni Press is have they been really good to work with? Everybody I talk to really likes Oni.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy working with them. I have not really had any complaints. A lot of people I know have had a few complaints, but like, I've been working with them for now 10 years.
Yeah.
No problem.
Do they put their hands in what you do, or are they more hands off? Just, oh, okay, yeah, just go write and draw it, bring it back to us, and we'll publish it.
They're a little too hands off. You know, I finally my editor, my current editor on it, like, we, you know, they kind of expanded, and like my editor became the editor in chief, and, you know, and then they hired more editors. But like, my current editor, I call her up and I say, well, what do you think of this? Can you help me with this? Can we workshop it a little bit? Is there problems with it? And she's so wonderful and supportive. And like, I have to kind of, it's like pulling teeth to get her to say, I'm not crazy about this bit or that bit, you know? And so, you know, like, I would like a little more interference. I don't want, like, you know, Vertigo Comics levels of interference, but I, you know, because I feel like you kind of end up stifling creativity when you just start, when you have an idea of what you think the book should be, and you start telling the author what that, I, you know, like, that doesn't really add up for me. With Oni, like, I would like a little more guidance, but they seem to be happy with what I come up with, and I've more or less happy with what everything I come up with at the end of the day. And kind of, and like, and they also, Oni's the ones that said, you know what, Ted, we'd love to do your next project, Princess Ugg, the barbarian princess that has to go to princess finishing school.
Mm-hmm.
But really what we really want to do is another Courtney book, because it's the 10-year anniversary and we really want to push everything that you've done before and just keep the momentum going.
Yeah.
And I kind of have to go, yeah, well, you know, that makes more financial sense. So that's the influence I get from them. That's all the interference I get from them. Do this, not do more of this and a little less of that.
In my research, I saw that, I guess in 2005, it was Eisner nominated for, was it Best Title for Younger Audiences?
Yes.
Is that right? Do you really consider Courtney Crumman to be a younger book? I mean, it's... Again, you beat me to the punch. I was so proud of my Roald Dahl comparison. Uh-huh. But yeah, I mean, you seem to be the heir apparent to him, where it's, I guess it's a kid's book, if you want to call it
Absolutely.
That. But it's got a pretty deep dark side to it, too, that I think you kind of have to be an adult to appreciate.
I don't think so. I don't agree with that at all. I think
really?
Kids love dark stuff. I did. I loved dark stuff as a kid. The darker, the better. I remember becoming fascinated with really dark children's stories. I don't think that, like, I found that, like, when I, as a kid, like, it was, general rule was, you know, when stuff it was made for all audiences, I loved it. If stuff was made for kids, I hated it.
Well, on the back of the book, it does say 7 and up.
I have had, you know, unlike kids, I've had 7-year-olds find, like, Volume 2 a little too scary.
Volume 2 is my favorite.
You know, the hobgoblin that's, like, stalking the family and the whole bit.
Before we called you, Adam and I were talking about that, just doing some basic for the show, and we both agree that we think that Volume 2 is probably the strongest one, just in terms
yeah.
of the storytelling and the art meshing and really finding your feet.
Yeah, I've heard that from a lot of people. My mom liked the second one the best, too, and wasn't crazy about the fourth one. But, you know, I just got to produce what I produce. It's hard to say to yourself, no, I'm going to do better. I can't really put my finger on what makes the second one the best, but it's definitely, it is stronger than the others.
Your mom told you she wasn't crazy about the fourth one?
Yeah, yeah. she's very straightforward about it. Like, she's a huge fan. She really loves the stuff, and she's incredibly supportive. So, like, when she gives me criticism, you know, I know that it's really, you know, it means something. It means a lot. And so that's good.
Now, Joel, and I'm not positive what's in the fourth one. Joel told me that, like, I have right now what Joel let me borrow. I do have Fire Thief's Tale, and I also have Portrait of the Warlock as a young man.
Fire Thief's Tale is the first half of the fourth volume.
Okay. Okay.
The Portrait of a Warlock is a spinoff book that I did about Aloysius when he was a teenager.
I really like that one, too.
Yeah? Well, I just did a sequel for it. That's how.
Excellent. I read that and I was like, you know, I never, like, you think it's like, man, it'd be cool to know more about Aloysius, but the story is Courtney Crumman and I'm cool with that. But then you did mm-hmm. that story, the backstory about Aloysius, and it's like, well, damn, now I want to know, now I definitely want to know more stories from Aloysius' past. So
There's the sequel to that story, and then there's one more story about Aloysius that's a sort of an aside in the current Courtney Crumman series.
Okay.
I wrote it as the first issue for the new series, like an adventure, an Aloysius adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And then Oni just said, what the hell were you thinking? This is not a way to get new readers in. So we made that. That's going to be the fifth book in the series instead of the first.
Yeah.
And the next book I did after that is going to be the first book in the new series.
Gotcha. When I finished the first book of Courtney Crumran, I had actually just a few, I guess a couple months prior, I read Neil Gaiman's Graveyard book.
Oh yeah,
and
I haven't read that yet.
And I had a lot of, I was able to compare it a lot. Like, I when I first read Courtney Crumman, I immediately started comparing it to Graveyard book, mainly because, you know, Graveyard book is, it's a story about a kid who's raised by ghosts in a graveyard and like a caretaker mm-hmm. kind of guy. So, and he goes on these mystical adventures and he learns more about stuff and there's a bigger story and all this stuff like that. So when I started reading Courtney Crumran, I was like, okay, well, this is a girl. She's in this world of magic all of a sudden out of nowhere. And, you know, she's raised by this guy who's kind of creepy looking and stuff like that. And I compared it a lot. But by the time I got to volume 2, I stopped comparing it to Graveyard book and I started comparing it to Courtney Crumran. And it became its own thing at that point. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, when I read 1, I had that comparison, but when I read 2, I only compared it to Courtney Crumran at that point. And I think that's why I think 2 may be the the strongest for me so far is because really that's the one that kind of broke that mold for me and made it, this is Courtney Crummer. Like when I read two, anything I was kind of reading and I was like, if I would question this or I would question that, you know, when I read two, I stopped questioning everything because I found that this is what this world is. This is what this is supposed to be. And, and I was able to like accept a lot of things and that's really what, yeah, like I said, broke the mold and allowed me to say, you know, I got to read the rest of this stuff, you know, at that
point. It's funny how that works that's really, it's exciting to hear that you feel like the world is assertive enough and strong enough that in its own rules that you aren't comparing it to other books that are living in similar worlds.
Right.
That
it, absolutely.
It has its own very specific identity.
Yeah.
And that's I really appreciate that. And, you can't put your finger on why something that's perfectly good just doesn't feel like it's its own thing, doesn't feel like it's its own world. And like another thing that may not even be as good, definitely can have a stronger personal or unique stamp, like its own voice that's its own thing. And that's always what I've kind of striven to. Is that the word? Driven?
It is now.
I didn't go to college. That's what I have all often strived to do, but it's nice to know that it kind of worked out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll tell you, like, I was flipping through previews, and after I'd read the second volume, I was flipping through previews, and I saw that you have, you know, you've got the new Courtney Crummer coming out, and it's going to be the first Courtney Crummer in color, and, you know, I immediately wrote it down to put it on my pull list, even though I haven't even finished what's already out, so.
Oh, the color is so good. I'm really delighted. And it is not, like, I mean, it was funny, because I was given two options, and one was this kind of, like, only spottily available in high demand colors that was like one of the main colors over at Oni, and he just did this fantastic job.
Yeah.
And then there was this other guy who was just kind of starting out who was very available, but his color was a little bit like, really? Is that how you're going to do this? Mm. Okay, that's a little bit strange. And I chose him. I was like, no, I want that guy. I want somebody who is going to take chances, is going to do something like a little unexpected and weird, is going to go more for atmosphere than for like tried and true methods. And he has just really blossomed. Like as you can see, the book as it went on, you know, he's doing all these little color experiments of like very restrained color and then very monochromatic color and all of these neat, and then my favorite bits are the bits where he's clearly using the color to tell the story more.
Okay.
So, like, in volume one, the scene where Courtney is sitting down at the lunch table and everybody abandons it, the background is bright blue, and then as she sits down and everybody looks over and notices her, the blue has become very, very desaturated. And then when she sits down and everybody's left the table, the background has become gray.
Yeah.
And it's subtle enough that if you weren't really paying attention, you wouldn't even notice it. But it's neat to watch her world become very drab and sad in that, you know, that moment where she, you know, she's kind of realizing that she's just, even though she doesn't really like any of the people at her school, there's just something kind of horrible about like not even having the option to just kind of make friends with the people that you don't particularly have that much interest in and make the best of it. You know, she's just that isolated. And I love how the color tricks that Warren did were, you know, just really capture that beautifully, just how the world just kind of gets leached, all the joy and happiness just leaches away.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, you look at the books like, you look at the Courtney Crummer books and like they're not in color, but they completely tell a story. So it's interesting, like if you're looking at the idea of adding color or using color, if it's not going to contribute to the story, there's really no purpose in it being there, right?
Yeah.
So I'm glad to hear that it contributes.
Even really good color, like it doesn't need, you know, even really good quality color. Like I've so often seen black and white books get colorized, and no matter how good it is, it didn't need to be there.
Yeah.
Or, you know, books getting like old books that were colored in the traditional four-color process being recolored, like the old Sandman book. Like I kind of like the original Sandman colors better than the modern kind of, you know, slopped out recolor.
Yeah.
You know, like they're not dramatically better. They're just kind of toned down and a little less kind of weird and garish.
So what led to the color decision?
It makes more money, one. And it's, you know, Oni is starting to do a lot of color books. They have a system in place. They have a printer that they've been working with for a while. It was mainly just, let's sell the book again and get people that wouldn't have been interested in the black and white. But the other thing is, you know, I've always wanted it to be in a hardcover and to make it more book-like. And you wouldn't believe how beautiful this book came out. Like, we did this print where I wanted a just a whole reprinting of the book with a different logo, because I'd been making the logos, and I had just done these comic book covers where it was just an illustration with a logo on top. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't want that. I wanted a cover that looked like a book. So we had the designer come up with something, and then I did new art for it. But it's mainly a designed cover instead of an art cover. It has art on it, but it's mainly this design piece, and just that makes, and a new logo that their designer came up with, Keith Wood is his name.
I will throw out, I really do like the covers.
I'm sorry?
I really do like the covers.
you like the old covers?
Yeah, I do like them, yeah.
Yeah, no, they're good, but I just wanted something that looks like, when you pick it up, it's a handsome volume, like a really handsome volume. And that's exactly what we got. You won't believe how gorgeous this new hardcover is.
Awesome.
I don't mean to be... Like, I'm not here to, like, you know, plug the hardcover. That's just kind of what's going on in my life, and I'm really excited about it. Like, I'm carrying the thing around with me in my apartment. Like, it's like, pick it up. And the colors, we printed it on matte paper, so the colors are kind of, like kind of light and a little less rich.
Uh-huh.
And that really helps. It makes them even kind of more handsome.
Yeah.
And it's just a really pretty book. You know, I'm really excited about dressing up Courtney, giving her, and like basically doing like a sort of like a, like taking the like $7,000 version of El Mariachi and then dressing it up as the $107,000 version of El Mariachi with the, you know, the new soundtrack and the, you know, all the little extras.
Yeah.
You know, it's still the same thing, but it's dressed up a bit.
Well, like I said, I borrowed all these books from Joel, so I've got room up on my shelf for a beautiful hardback collection.
Oh, for your own set.
Yes, I
do. Oh, yeah. Well, just wait till this comes out in stores. I think you'll be attracted. So I have a question for you.
Okay.
Regarding this. You say that it took you forever to get around to reading it.
Yeah, it did. It did.
Why?
Well, you know, it's funny. Like, honestly, Joel mailed him to me. He said, hey, you know, I want to interview this guy. Have you read his stuff? And I said, no. And he said, I'm going to mail it to you. And I said, okay. And he mailed it to me. And I think I opened the box and I said, hey, there's books in here. I don't even think I took them out of the box. I think he mailed them to me. I set them in the corner and I said, I'll get to these. And like, they got buried under stuff. And Joel said, hey, do you still have those books? And I said, oh my God, I do. And I pulled them out.
Uh-huh.
And like, as soon as I started reading them, like I said, I was like, as soon as I read the first one, I said, Joel, set up the interview.
Oh, great. Thanks.
So
what was it that made you, I mean, was it sort of like your, you know, Netflix instant watchers, all these movies that you've always said, oh, yeah, I should watch that, and then you never do? Is it that kind of thing, or was there something about it that turned you off?
No, it comes down to my New Year's resolution was to read all of my graphic novels and trade paperbacks on my bookshelf.
Uh-huh.
I had 116 I hadn't read yet.
Oh, yeah.
And that was...
I get books all the time from Oni, and like there's some I've had for years that I've never gotten around to that I keep meaning to. Like, I need to read this, but
Read Krogan's Vengeance yet?
I've not read Krogan's Vengeance. I hear it's amazing.
Excellent.
And it's sitting on my bookshelf waiting to be read.
The third one's coming out soon. Well, it's a quick read. It's a quick read.
Uh-huh.
It's excellent. There's a lot of Oni books that I would happily plug. It just came down to I had a priority, and it was to read the books I owned, and I set aside the ones I didn't own and didn't get to them. I still have about since I bought more now, of course, I still have about 80 graphic novels that I haven't read yet for this year. So, but these definitely stepped up in the queue once I read that first one.
Yay! Well, I'm glad you liked them.
Yeah,
and please let me know when you get to the new ones. And I, you know, like if you want to drop me a line, let me know what you think.
Yeah, because you know, obviously, like I could probably and it seems like and you could. We could probably talk about Courtney Crumman for a really long time. So maybe when I finish reading or when the new ones start coming out. Now, is that the new ones issues? Are they going to be ongoing?
Yeah, it's an ongoing series.
Okay, cool.
I'm 4 issues in, and I'm starting. I just finished laying out the 5th.
Okay, cool.
Which, if my editor heard me say that, she'd probably kill me because I'm supposed to be done with it. Right?
Yeah. Well, I won't post this for probably a few weeks anyway. So.
Okay, good. Yeah.
so hopefully,
by the time like I'll be delivering the book at the same time that this will get posted.
Yeah. But so, yeah, so maybe when that starts rolling out, we can actually do a Courtney Crumburn show. One more quick question about the Courtney Crumburn before I hand it over to Joel. What led to the design of the character's fingers?
I was a big fan of, I'm a big fan of Dave McKean, and he, I had liked his, like, extra sharp, jagged, cartoony style, and that's kind of how I was drawing cartoony characters. And then my style evolved. But what do? Start adding an extra finger, start, like, drawing fingernails? I just felt like it was a signature that I had developed when I first designed the character.
Yeah.
And also, you know, Joan and Vasquez's cartoons, like, I mean, Dave McKean and Joan Vasquez, they have so much in common as creators. But Joan Vasquez's cartoon style also has, like, sharp, pointy fingers. And I was also, was I watching Invader Zim? No, Invader Zim hadn't come out yet. But I had seen designs and stuff, and I kind of liked that sharp, jagged, cartoony, gothic design. And then as the book became more about, you know, like, had developed more of a fantasy aesthetic, the fingers kind of started to stick out more and be weirder. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to start adding a fourth finger, because that would not be that book anymore.
Yeah.
Like, that would kind of really, that would be a solid way of abandoning the art style I had developed for it. It's the same thing with Courtney's face, you know, like her nose, her missing nose and whatnot.
Yeah.
That was because I had originally developed it to be a much more cartoony book. And I had planned to have much more children, like to have her interacting mostly with other children and monsters. And then Aloysius would be the one anomalous character that was, like, more developed and more, like, realistic because he's a grown-up. But then more grown-ups started appearing in the story, and I just ended up drawing them all realistically. And so Courtney kind of is the one character that really stands out, having no nose, mm-hmm. not even in profile, and just being extra, kind of extra simplistic and cartoony.
And I've also noticed a lot of times that she had, like, I was flipping through and she has the big black eyes, and a lot of the other kids, they just have white eyes, I've noticed as well.
Yeah, nobody else has big black eyes except her.
Yeah.
And then her teacher. That was, like, also, like, a notable thing. Well, I had read Understanding Comics, and in Understanding Comics, there's a lot of talk about, you know, taking your main character and making them a little bit simpler than the other characters. Like, Cerebus was the only character that was rendered in Zipitone, and, like, a little bit, like, the only character that was an animal, a talking animal. Tintin is a little more cartoony than anybody else in the book, and, you know, et cetera. You know, it kind of goes, the list goes on. In order to make the character become, like, you're trying to make your character as close as possible to a smiley face so that the reader can look at it and go, ah, I see, that's me, you know, and, like, and, you know, and not have all of these other, you know, like, specific features that make them unique individual people, but have all these kind of vague, bland features that make them more universal.
Yeah.
And I kind of wanted Courtney to be able to feel a little more universal.
Okay. All right. I was going to ask more questions, but I'm going to stop. I'm going to stop myself. And like I said, maybe we'll talk more about the design and stuff at a later date.
I just had one additional question about Courtney.
No, we're moving on from Courtney.
No, I'm going to ask my one question, and you're going to sit there and like it.
Okay, go ahead.
Is she going to be perpetually the same age, or do you have plans to age her as the series goes along?
She's going to stay the same age, more or less. I mean, right? She's gone from more like 11-ish to 13-ish. Although now I realize that I probably should have just left her at 13 from beginning to end, because, like, you just don't let an 11-year-old babysit. You shouldn't really be letting a 13-year-old babysit. But it's a fantasy story for kids. That's one thing. Like, in kid world, older kids babysit for younger kids.
Ted, let me ask you. I mean, as far as seems like with Courtney going monthly, it seems like your heart is still more of a small press guy. Is that right?
Well, it's not. I mean, it is, you know, oh boy. I mean, yes, it is. I love small press, and I kind of like, I mean, like, the thing is, it's not that I love my ideas more than I love other ideas. It's just that I like the control that I get with my own ideas. I mean, it's, you know, like, and largely, I mean, like, one of the, you know, like, if I were to go write Batman, no matter what I came up with, people would be like, oh, yeah, no, you can't use that character because that character is currently dead. Oh, no, you can't use that character because turns out Aunt Harriet is not Bruce's aunt. She's Dick Grayson's aunt, so you can't use her as Bruce's aunt, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, all of these little things, like, no matter how much lore I think I know about this stuff, there's always somebody saying, oh, no, 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 Hugo Strange would never do that, you know. So it's, all in all, it's more convenient to make up my own lore for my own characters. A friend of mine is he's getting into publishing. He's making his own like steampunk superhero novel series, and he's a big proponent of, you know, hanging on to your own creative, you know, just producing your own creative properties and, you know, owning it yourself and even publishing it yourself. Now it's just so damned easy to publish, to self-publish. You know, you just write a book and put it on ebooks and see what happens. You know, if you play your cards right, you can, you know, make a pretty comfortable living that way, apparently. Mm-hmm. Of course, I mean, he also, you know, like, he's just starting out, so I don't know. I mean, it might be a different story for me, but it might be a different story for making novels as opposed to making comic books. But who knows, at some point in the near future, it could just be the best way to go is just to, like, knock something out, put it out on the internet, get some fans of it, and then publish it. What do you call it? I guess you do made-to-order books where it's just print-on-demand.
Yeah. Now, because you've been doing small press for so long, what have you noticed as the changes from when you first started to now?
Well, you know, it's funny because when small press first started off, they wanted to do all miniseries that would ultimately be bound up as graphic novels, right? Mm-hmm. The original Courtney Kermerin thing, I wanted to do it as a monthly series. And they said, well, no, we're going to do it as a miniseries because, you know, we need that number one on there to really make sell. Number two sells half of the amount of number one, and number three sells about two-thirds of what number two sells, and et cetera. Yeah. And then finally they just gave up on that because nobody bought any of them. They would just wait for the trade. If they knew the trade was coming, they'd wait for the trade because readers wanted the trade. So they just kept the ongoing series and just, you know, would commission people to do trades. And that was like after, you know, that started about 5 years ago. And now... They're like, well, neither of those models seem to work anymore. We can't get the trades going because it just takes too long for artists to produce them for no money. So we're just going to do ongoing series from now on. And if they, like, I write novels at night or on weekends when they hold down real jobs. But you can't really draw a comic book while holding down a real job, I feel. Unless, you know, like, I know one guy who, you know, works at Pixar, which is a real job. And then he does a comic book on the side that, you know, and it's really good. You know, he doesn't have time to do an ongoing series. He barely has time to think much about it or to really devote himself to it and make and kind of get that kind of momentum going. He just kind of knocks something out every once in a while, and it's great. And then he has to forget about it and, like, go and make his real money and do his real work. You know, like, I just don't want to do that. I'm thinking too well of my own abilities, but I could presumably go get a job at Pixar. But I would rather, you know, stick with what I'm doing and just kind of, because I love it, and I really don't want to work on Cars 3.
Yeah.
And I just hope for the, you know, and I don't have, you know, I don't have kids, I don't have a mortgage. I'm hoping for the best. I'm hoping at some point that I'll eventually start earning enough money to be able to pay for a retirement. Not that I'd ever retire.
Yeah.
Now, you said something earlier that about UGG. It was going to be another in your little girls. What is it about dark themes or dark work and seemingly little girls that in your comics, what keeps drawing you towards that area?
I have no idea. I mean, the dark stuff, I just can't. Like Polly, you know, you look at Polly and the Pirates, the original, the first one that I drew. And, you know, like when you read it, it's not really dark. But when you look at it, it's got a lot of atmosphere to it because I can't seem to help it. I love dropping in shadows. You know, I had a lot of influence from Mike Mignola, and I kind of like, and, you know, I always loved, like, you know, the people that he loved, like Ernie Wrightson and that, and just the atmosphere that's created by lots of big dense blacks and lots of shadows dropped in, all that stuff. And there's just something about that atmosphere that I'm really attracted to. And so Polly the Pirates ended up looking a little gothier than I really intended it to be. But I can't help it. I don't know why. It's kind of the way it is. As for the, you know, why I keep drawing little girls or doing stories about little girls, I have no idea either. I'm actually just starting to come up with ideas for, you know, young adult and children's stories for about boys. And it's a lot harder because you have to be a little more honest with about who you are, you know, or I have to be more honest about who I really am.
Yeah.
And, you know, what it was like to grow up as a boy and all that stuff. And I feel like, you know, writing about girls keeps honesty at a certain amount of distance, I think, for me.
What are you actually like? I mean, I'm sure people have people tend to want to take somebody's work and project it onto the artist. You know, people always have this vision of Edgar Allan Poe being all dark and gothy, but in reality, you know, there are stories of him playing leapfrog and enjoying jokes and, you know, all this other stuff. What do you actually like?
What am I like.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming that your apartment isn't black drapes and skulls all over the walls. What is the biggest misconception about you in that way?
Well, I mean, my apartment is I've been decorating my apartment all in Art Deco. Like, I'm trying to go for like a 40s gumshoe apartment or like a Gotham City apartment. Mm-hmm. God, that sounds horribly nerdy, doesn't it? Don't laugh at me. I'm cool.
When you do a comic convention, who comes up to you mostly? I mean, do you get mainly children that come up, or do you get mainly adults that come
up
to you?
Everybody. You know, what I don't tend to get is idiots. I see a lot of idiots running around conventions, but I don't have a lot of idiot fans.
Like, I know Joel got a commission from you.
You know, does that make sense?
Yeah.
I feel like there's a lot of idiot fans among comic book fans.
Yep.
You know, like like dorks that, you know, dorks that just kind of, and I was one of them, you know, I'm not going to lie. But I feel like, you know, my fans tend to be a little more thoughtful. They tend to be alternative people, but not all, you know. Of course, I mean, most comic people are alternative people to some extent, but like, I tend to, all ages, all genders, like there's a lot of variety. But what they have in common is that they're all kind of like, I mean, they're not drawn. I mean, one thing, you know, here's what it is. I think that one thing that I'm noticing about, you know, comics in general is that, like, there's like a strong, like, attraction among your typical comic book fan to the machismo of comics. Those fans, for one reason or another, do not seem to be all that attracted to my work. It could possibly be that most machismo type comic book fans are not interested in reading stories about, you know, preteen girls.
It could be.
I mean, it's a theory.
Yeah, it could be.
No, I don't know too many adult men that, oh yeah, hey, 11-year-old girl, let's pick this up.
That, I mean, I think that that's been a big problem for me in the direct market. I mean, I'm not unhappy that I chose this subject matter, but I feel like a lot of the time people don't pick up Courtney Cameron because, like, they look at it and they go, well, this is clearly not for me.
What do you think about, like, you mentioned the direct market, and I mean, what do you think about the atmosphere of comic books and family-friendly comics? I mean, from what I see, they tend to get shunned off, and usually they're just, like, really good, and I don't understand. Well, I do understand but what do you think about, like, the whole atmosphere of the direct market and comics and family-friendly and all that stuff?
The thing is that the direct market is it's a hobbyist store. You know, comics stores are for comics enthusiasts. There's no room for casual comics readers at comic book shops. I remember going into a shop, like my local shop is Comics Experience. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, the proprietor was like, when I first walked into a comic book shop, the guy who owns Comics Experience now, where, you know, he's a teenager and he was working at this store. And he, you know, and I wandered the store looking at all this amazing stuff that I had no ingress into, like picking up an issue of Cerebus and going, this looks really cool, but I have no way. I cannot pick this up and start reading it. That it doesn't make any sense. It's clearly like chapter 42 in a 500 chapter story.
Yeah.
I mean, you could just tell that you're jumping in the middle, and there's just no, you know, and there's no way to just start collecting single issues and get it all. It's just that aspect of it was not appealing to me, going hunting down issues and like piecing together the story, and that kind of pieced me away. I wanted to start at the beginning and continue until I got to the end. So like, I felt like I just had no way in. And so finally in desperation, I walk up to Brian Hibbs, the guy, and I, you know, I'd never met him before. And I say, you know, is there anything that you would recommend to a first time reader? And he handed me Matt Wagner's Mage, the
good choice.
Like three more or less standalone issues of Swamp Thing that were really wonderful. And like one other thing, I think it was, I can't remember what it was, but it was Mage and Swamp Thing, and they were both just astonishingly amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, Swamp Thing was like the hottest thing going on at the time. Watchmen hadn't right. started yet. But it was just, I mean, it just completely knocked my socks off. And that was like, I mean, but that you need to be able to do that. And also, like, I was lucky that I managed to meet someone who had this similar taste to me, who was able to recognize that, or, like, I mean, I was told him that I liked Dark Knight, what else you got? And just, you know, was able to kind of communicate that. But you can't say that to, I mean, that's the thing. You have to have that personal touch. There's no system in place to walk into a store, see something on a shelf, instantly go, oh, well, you know, everybody's talking about this, so I will get it. You know, this Harry Potter thing, everybody's talking about it, therefore I will get it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, unless you're in the comic book scene, there's nobody's talking about it. you know, it's hard to, like, what are the comics that people are all talking about? They're still talking about, you know, Watchmen and Dark Knight. You know, nobody seems to be talking about anything new.
I guess The Walking
Especially
Dead.
Especially things for young kids.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, I feel like the big problem with doing books for young kids is that, the difficulty I'm having is that there's no venue for it. There was this hope that bookstores were going to start embracing comic books for young kids, but they just never did. They kind of teased, they sort of played with it. I occasionally would see Disney comics on the shelves at grocery stores, and nobody was buying them. And I picked them, and they were like cheap paperbacks. Nobody was buying them, and they just didn't look that interesting.
Comics kind of now kind of sit in that netherworld where we've made such an effort to. They're not for kids. So we've kind of hurt ourselves in the way now people don't really believe that they're for kids anymore. You know, because I think the average comic reader is in his mid-20s.
I mean, I was right there. You know, I was one of the people going, you know, taking an interest in comics because I was electrified by the idea of a comic book for adults.
Right.
It's so transgressive because it's so grown. It's a comic book that's grown up. How cool is that? So I was one of the people that was responsible as a reader that was responsible for, you know, changing the way people perceived comics, which turned out not to be such a good thing.
Mm. What are you reading now? I mean, what do you pick up when you go to the comic shop? Other than Batman?
These days, I mean, not much. Right? You know, like, I pick up the occasional Batman book. I pick up anything by Mike Mignola. But it's really hard to figure out, you know, to follow. Like, I don't know any, like, electrifying writers out there right now that I'm ready to follow that aren't. I mean, my problem is all the best writers in the business, they, you know, they get in the business, they do a few things, and then they wise up and they go work for the big two because that's where the money is. And then when they're working for the big two, they're not their own writer anymore. They're the DC writer. They're writing, you know, they're writing who DC tells them to write. And it's not that interesting because they're not their own voices anymore. Even get, like, people like Ed Brubaker, who did some amazing stuff with Gotham Central a couple of years ago. And, you know, Greg Rucka was writing amazing stuff on Batwoman. And then, you know, he just, like, but the problem with Batwoman is that he was, like, orders to include this character and that character, and then he dutifully did it, and then they let him go.
Well, I mean, we haven't talked about, like, the other books. Like, we haven't really talked about Death Jr. or Polly and the Pirates yet. Would you like to go into that?
I think Death Jr. is, like, one of the only things I know that you've worked on small press-wise that was not a creation of yours, correct?
Yeah. I mean, and then, of course, I got well paid for it. right. I mean, that was very much work for hire.
Yeah.
And, you know, not that I didn't enjoy it. It was definitely the right book to do at the time. But, it was work for hire. And that was that was kind of mainly what drew me to it. But the original idea with Death Jr. was, you know, I just did this single 22-page issue that was a promotional book for the video game, while the video game was being developed. Video game publisher was looking for a way to promote it, and one of the artists on it, one of the, like, the key animator, was a fan of my work and had met me a couple of times because we ran in the same circles when we were young adults. And she recommended me as a, you know, as the artist for it. And so we kind of came up with this little short, funny little comic book, and it was such a huge hit that, like, instantly Disney jumped up and said, hey, we want to buy this. We want to make this into a movie. And they got greedy and they said, well, that's great, but now we're interested in developing it as a movie, so we're going to do a whole graphic novel and bump up the cost of it so that we can sell it as a movie. And I don't know if they ever sold it as a movie, but I got paid pretty good for, you know, illustrating the comic book for it. And they hired a screenwriter, Gary Whitta, who is now a pretty damn successful screenwriter, to write the comic book version, and he was also going to be writing the screenplay, which probably would have been awesome, but I never, you know, of course, Death Jr. never became a movie, tragically.
I enjoyed Death Jr. I thought it was really good. I was kind of disappointed to see there were only the two volumes.
You know, I think I just was, it was a great story. The second story was pretty great, but I was getting tired of doing it just because it wasn't my thing.
Right.
And I was really struggling with, like, working with an assistant and trying to, you know, speed up the process, and it just didn't really, I was really struggling with that, and it just didn't work out. I wasn't really super happy with the results because I just didn't really understand the process very well because I had never been an assistant. At the end of the day, I kind of, you know, I feel like, you know, maybe I'll do it differently if I do work for hire like that again. But, like, I just got kind of frustrated with the whole process of doing more kind of commercial work. And also just eating doing the colors just ate up so much time. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I guess nowadays they hire professional people to flat color.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Interns and stuff.
And it's like $10 a page for flat color.
Yeah.
Something like that. And just, but at the end of the day, I mean, I was never really, I would always take way too long to color a page, and I was never really satisfied with it unless I just really massaged it.
Yeah.
And I just didn't have time to massage, like, you know, like 50 pages of an issue, and then like 150 page graphic novel. That was just a lot of, it just ate up way too much time.
If I remember correctly, reading the Courtney Kroman hardcover with the color and all that, that's coming out in April. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay. Do they have a release schedule for the rest of them, or are they, is this just kind of a test run
on the first one? I'm not sure when the next one's coming out. I know that the first one is coming out in April, and once it's out, then I'm assuming that, you know, it's so gorgeous that I'm assuming that everybody who buys it is going to want, you know, instantly to run out and buy everything else, and they'll be paying attention.
Well, like I said,
eyes open for the next one.
I borrowed them from Joel, so that means there's room on my shelf to go ahead and pick up the new color ones.
Oh, the color ones are, yeah, yeah.
So,
did I mention how often they are?
Yes, yes, you did. No, I look forward to it. I look forward to it, though.
I never double dip. I never double dip, but you're forcing me to buy it again, Ted.
I'm sorry. Well, you know what you do is you take the paperbacks and you give them to someone that you think will become a fan, and then they've got them, and then they become a fan, and then they give them to someone else when they buy the hardcovers.
Which means,
and then it just keeps going like that.
Which means that way I don't have to mail them back to you.
You don't get to keep them, Adam. That was not a Christmas gift. You will have to send it back. Ted, let me tell you that I just want to thank you personally, because, like I said, you did do the sketch for my wife a couple years ago, and it's the only piece of art, comic art, that I'm allowed to hang up on the walls, actually.
I saw that on your comic art.
My wife, when she moved in, made me take all of the other comic art. She goes, but that one can stay.
What did she make you take down?
I had a covered like Quasar. I had a two-page splash from the Avengers by Mike Diodato. She made me take down, and a couple other pieces. I can't remember off the top of my head, but she says, no, that one can stay.
Well, that one you
the rest
got
of them you have
her,
to take
right?
down. Yeah. But, you know, when I first met my wife, she didn't really understand my fascination with comics. Again, she had this conception that they were just for kids. And so your book was the first thing that I handed her. I was like, well, I think this might be, it's not superhero-y, because she didn't want to get into superheroes with the capes and the tights. So I gave it to her. And she still doesn't quite understand my fascination with comics to the level that I have it, but she understands better. And, you know, your book is the one she keeps making me go find the next issue, go find the next. So, you know, you really helped. You were a good gateway for my wife kind of into this hobby that we all have. So I want to thank you for that.
Oh, well, I'm happy to oblige. I always like to think that, I definitely, when I first started off doing comics, like wanted to write my own stuff. That was one of my goals, is to, like, there was this huge gap in the market where there were all of these women I knew that were interested in comics and were interested in the art form. But there was nothing for them. I mean, there really just wasn't much.
Right.
And it was kind of, I felt like, well, you know, I may not be that great, but I can definitely do this because nobody else is really doing this.
No, it's definitely, like I said, my wife, I tried to hand her some Spider-Man, didn't want to read it, tried to read her, and this she got. She goes, okay, I understand why you read this. I still don't understand why you're spending so much money on it, but, you know, she understands a little better. So.
Okay. Well, that's good. Actually, it reminds me of a scene in a comic by, what is his name? Zot. It was a Zot comic, and it's by Scott McCloud. And there was like a scene where it was about a teenage boy who had just had his first girlfriend, taking her to the comic book store to buy herself her own copy of The Dark Knight Returns, which, of course, every girl wants a copy of The Dark Knight Returns because, you know, it's a real girl's comic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, like, and he was complaining that she got distracted by Bean World. And he had to get her away from the Bean World comic.
Because the funny thing is, I handed her, I remember Spider-Man, Marvel's, Kingdom Come, Courtney Cromerin, and something else. She's like, don't want it. I'll read Courtney.
Ted, you've got the Courtney Cromerin coming out. It's in previews now. And hopefully, maybe when that starts getting out and I can start reading a few of those, we can get back together and we can do a full-on Courtney Crumrin interview. And
yeah, I mean, well, I thought we just did one. I mean, that was kind of mostly what I was talking about.
I can talk more about Courtney Crumrin.
You know, if you want to, I'm game. I'm, you know, I love doing it.
I feel as though I've cut myself short on that one.
Well,
there's still a few other questions I could probably come up with. So.
Anytime.
Yeah,
if you're open to it, we'll come back closer to Christmas time after, you know, half a dozen issues or so have come out, and you know, we'll just tear the whole series apart. Ted, thank you again for all of your time, and thank you for putting out Courtney, and congratulations on being able to turn it into a monthly. That doesn't happen often with the small press stuff.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thanks for calling, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to gab.
Absolutely. Right. Well,
thank you, Ted. You have a good night, buddy.
Yeah.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, guys.